In the early hours of February 1st, 2021, Myanmar's military seized political control of the country. The unexpected coup has sent shockwaves across the world, leading political figures from the ruling National League for Democracy government, or NLD, were detained, including State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi and President Win Myint. More than 40 government officials from the party were also arrested. The new military government, under its leader, Army Chief Min Aung Hlaing, then declared a one-year state of emergency. He also pledged to call for new elections after the end of the emergency, although no time frame was mentioned. The military coup took place just hours before the new parliament was set to convene for the first time since the November 2020 general election. The polls returned the NLD to power by a wide margin. The Myanmar Armed Forces, known as the Tatmadaw, however, rejected the election results, blaming election fraud for its poor performance. But what really prompted the military to topple a democratically elected government? What are the key motivations behind the power grab?
Welcome, and you're watching CNA Inside. This is a special edition, a panel discussion, as we look into the shocking developments in Myanmar. First, a military coup, and now martial law. What exactly is unraveling in Myanmar now? What are the immediate and long-term consequences of the situation? And most importantly, is Myanmar's experiment with democracy truly and well over? I'm Genevieve Wu, and I'm privileged to be joined by my guest today, Associate Professor Maitri Aung Thuynh, Department of History, National University of Singapore. Maitri is a specialist in Myanmar history, politics, and society. Associate Professor Eduardo Orarao from the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, Ed holds a PhD in public policy, and he has provided advisory and consultancy support to ASEAN governments, including in Myanmar. So, Assistant Professor Elliot Presser-Freeman, Department of Sociology, National University of Singapore. Now, Elliot has conducted long-term field work in Myanmar with a special focus on, among other things, activism and ethnic conflict. And joining us from Yangon in Myanmar is Thinza Shunleyi, a leading youth activist in Myanmar who has worked extensively with youth and grassroots movements in Myanmar. Thank you for joining me today, everybody. Now, this military coup, martial law in Myanmar is a developing story. Tensions are running high in the country. There's a lot of uncertainty, mainly because of the unpredictability of what's next or the next steps of the military government. Thinza, you are there in Yangon now, and you have just come back from some of the protests and the street demonstrations. Tell us, what's the mood like on the ground, Thinza?
It's not just small protests where and there, but it's like massive protest. It's clearly an uprising. It's not just in Yangon. It's not just in urban areas, but also across the whole nation, in different places in ethnic areas. So I see the people are uprising against the dictatorship. So many people are joining in. So the mood we have right now is that we don't have nothing more to lose, so we are ready to fight and we become fearless. So this is the feeling that I have. And as an activist, being active for the past decade, I feel like, you know, I've never seen such crowd before. We've been mobilizing different generations to get on streets, but this is the biggest ever that we see.
Now, Maitri, you've got friends and family in Myanmar. What have you heard on the ground?
Well, the news that the military was going to be stepping in was shocking for most of my family and colleagues. I had one colleague mention that our dreams are shattered, actually. And so it obviously hit everyone at a very emotional point. Clearly with what we've seen on the streets and in other parts of the country, people are also being affected in a similar way. Mm-hmm. So clearly this is a very serious matter. And it's one that the military is going to be facing a huge challenge in the future if it wants to have a role in governance in the country in the future. How they're going to be able to play that role is going to be very difficult to see.
Okay. All right. Ed, now you've got students there and you've got many contacts in some of your work that you've done in Myanmar. What have you heard?
Some of my students have seen what happened in 2007. I have friends who have been detained. Kokogi is my friend, so he's been detained, including with the 200 others. But I think the Myanmar people are quite resilient. This is not new to them. They've gone through this, and they will survive with this with lots of hope and dignity intact.
Okay. Now, Elliot, you've been following very closely on the ground. What's different this time that you can see the movement on the ground?
So activism in Myanmar, it tends to be led by a sort of vanguard of professionalized, not professional in a opportunistic way, but people who are activists as a sort of vocation. And what's different about this particular uprising, as Shunlei puts it, is that it's really distributed across lots of different parts of society and being led not by that classic group of people, but by the youth, especially young women who are out there in the streets many times for the first time and protesting in really unique ways, sometimes making fun of the generals, pointing and realizing that making fun of them is one of the most powerful ways of undermining their sort of aesthetics of power. They want to stand above the people. They're bringing them down to size. And then the other thing that's really amazing is how distributed across classes and even ethnicities this is. And I guess it's early days. We don't know how sustainable this is, but maybe a reorganization of even inter-social relationships on the ground. And that gives me a lot of hope.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about this unhappiness, and we'll take a step back. What led to the coup? In fact, it was the military generals who were actually very unhappy, which then led them to this power grab. Let's start with that. What was the unhappiness on that side, Maitri?
On the surface, the disagreement was over the results of the elections. They all felt that the results, there was a fraudulent election, despite international observance saying that it was a free and fair election. The military said that there were over 10 million complaints regarding the voting lists and so forth. And so it's a really perplexing situation for that issue to then culminate in this action of enacting emergency law. And for me and probably other scholars around there who are interested in constitutionalism and law, we're kind of interested in seeing, where is this evidence for this fraudulent election? So I think that's probably going to be an issue moving forward if an investigation actually occurs.
Okay, so that was the first trigger, the unhappiness over alleged election fraud. Were there other triggers?
Well, if you look at what the senior general said, they wanted a democracy with multi-party. Disciplined multi-party democracy. Discipline means the military will be there. Multi-party means a lot of parties contesting. Turned out that NLD is now the main party, and they felt sidelined. Maybe the others felt sidelined. And they said that if they don't take power now, then the new government might just continue to strengthen their base. That's why this is the right time for them to come in at the right time. During the pandemic, and of course the election was the pretext for all these irregularities was the pretext for them to come in.
Now Aung San Suu Kyi's party earlier last year had recommended a reduction of seats being held by the military from 25% down to 10% at some point. Now would this have caused alarm to the military and then led them to this power grab, Maitri?
I think in general, the military's view of not being involved in governance, or at least refereeing, as they tend to put it, would put them under some anxiety. They see themselves as defenders of the country and a protector from all risks, foreign and domestic. And so I think any sort of reduction in that ability to be a part of it in the way they set it up in 2010's elections would worry them. And any sort of reduction of their role, whether it's with their budget or whether it's their ability to govern, would definitely be a threat to them.
A trigger factor. Ed, what do you think?
Yeah, they tried with this experiment of the military pulling back, observing things, and so on. That probably they're not comfortable of being in the sidelines and watching the civilian government run the show.
Mm-hmm. Elliot, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the only thing I might add is that there's a sort of instrumental argument that they are better off on the sidelines, accumulating resources and remaining the one who decides the direction of the country. But I think there's also something to be said for the fact that they just like to be in power. Mm-hmm. And they don't like the fact that Aung San Suu Kyi gets to be the figurehead. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to overstate that, but it's probably in the mix.
Okay. Thinza, how do you feel? Was the military then feeling insecure about possibly being sidelined, which therefore led to the coup?
So I read an article talking about the military might coup, that there is a possibility if they feel like their core governance is being destroyed or being in danger and being threatened. So I think there was like a speculation around that. And I feel it's a high time for the military. They feel insecure about their future existence.
Now, speaking of staying in power, it's come up that, of course, General Min, the coup leader, is due for retirement this year. Could that have factored into the power grab, Elliot?
Yeah, so there's a concern that he wants to remain in the mix, and because of that retirement age, he cannot. There's also a suggestion that if he is not the head of the country, he is more susceptible to international law, such as the ICJ case. But these are, I think these speculations demonstrate how little we know about the internal mindset of the military right now, because we're kind of grasping at straws to try to make sense of something that on the surface doesn't seem like it makes much sense.
Maitri, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that his case also represents the broader anxiety of the military, of what to do with the senior generals and so forth at the top. There has to be an outlet. Otherwise, junior officers who are looking to be promoted are going to be running into their seniors, and they're never going to have that chance to lead. So that's what this system, I think, was set up to do, was to create a release. So they go into the civilian ranks, thereby also being closely connected still with the military, even though they're wearing civilian clothing. Mm-hmm. This system actually reproduces what the BSPP did in 1962, all the way to 88. It's the same system, different packaging. One was socialist, this one is democratic. Mm-hmm. This could have been a trigger when suddenly they realize this outlet is not happening, it's not working. Mm-hmm. Then what do we do? Because we've got junior guys coming up, we have nowhere to go. This might have been a possible reason for them to take these steps. Mm-hmm.
Thinza, one last question to you before we wrap up. Now, you're on the ground. Like you said, people are angry. It is now upgraded sort of to an uprising, not just civil disobedience. What are you guys expecting to happen next?
So there are different movements, different initiatives by different groups. So we feel there is no leader, one single leader anymore, just like in the past 10 years. So we feel like anything can happen out of it. So we are so decided to eventually overthrow that military gender. So we want a clear coalition with different parties coming up as a government. So this is our clear path that we are trying to down with the military regime. So this is the beginning for all of us to go for a future, inclusive future for all of us, a clear federal democratic nation.
All right, we're going to hold that thought for right now. We're going to take a short break. Now, speaking of the clear path that Thinza was talking about, now, in the last 10 years, Myanmar has made great gains in the democratic journey, but in one fell swoop, the gains seem to have vanished overnight. So when we come back, we'll look at Myanmar's long road to democracy and what's next after the coup and martial law. Stay with us.
Myanmar's transition towards a democratic government began in November 2010, after almost 50 years of military rule. However, the real, first, free and fair election only came in November 2015. That was when the military-backed USDP lost its majority. the National League for Democracy, or NLD, led by Aung San Suu Kyi, secured a supermajority, garnering 86% of seats in parliament. The 2015 election also signaled the beginning of a new hope for the country's transition to democracy. But despite the NLD winning the election by a landslide, the military still plays a dominant role in politics. Myanmar's military-drafted constitution reserves 25% of the total seats for military appointees. The military also controlled three powerful cabinet positions: defense, border security, and home affairs. The military suffered another blow in the November 2020 general elections. The NLD again emerged victorious, capturing 396 out of 476 seats in the combined lower and upper houses of parliament. The military's call for an investigation into alleged voting fraud was rejected by Myanmar's Election Commission. A coup on February 1st this year has ended Myanmar's decade-long experiment with democracy, prompting widespread protests against the new government. Will the move mark the end of the fragile democracy in Myanmar?
Welcome back. You're watching a special edition of CNA Insight as we look into what's been happening in Myanmar since the coup and now martial law. Let's take a step back and talk about Myanmar's democracy journey. Now, the last 10 years, the country has made great leaps in democratic reforms and opening up. Let's key in then to some of the top democratic reforms and how that has helped and improve the country.
Well, of course, the election in 2016 was the eye-opener, right? So it signaled to the world that the Myanmar is back in democracy, and that opened the door for Western investments, and sanctions have been lifted, right? But the West did not really follow through with what they promised. So they asked Myanmar to open up, but the investments were not there. The top two investors in Myanmar, Singapore and China. The West is quite, they played a quite marginal role. So people, or maybe the generals, are saying that, look, you tried this democracy, it didn't work, so we'll try it again. Mm. We will have a different version of this democracy.
Now, Thinsa, I mean, you're a young girl, you know, a young youth leader. In the last 10 years, or maybe last 5 years then, can you remember then the development and the improvements you've seen to your country?
In the past 10 years, you know, we felt like we were... For me, for myself personally, I was overjoyed with the result of civilian government. We never had that. I was overjoyed and I was cheering, I was campaigning. And then I realized I was also advocating in the parliament, me doing different. And I realized the constitution was not designed to amend through the parliament sessions. So we can't really do, we are trapped inside that framework. And I realized we're not really free. Before that, many people being detained, especially activists, young people, students. So we were never free. So as I see the freedom in terms of freedom index, in terms of democracy index, in terms of human rights index, we were not going anywhere, actually.
Speaking of the framework that you talk about, now, you know, Myanmar's path towards democracy was actually a top-down initiative. It was actually the military generals who wanted to start opening up the country to democratic reforms. Now, what was the thinking behind this? What prompted this change of heart, starting with 2003, I suppose, the military's drafted roadmap to democracy? Maitri.
The shift in 2003 to this roadmap to democracy had a lot to do with opening up the economy and at the same time investing in a different type of model. And the models that were being encouraged by the rest of the world was a more liberal democratic one, which had separation of power, which had a more liberal sense of the use of the press, freedom to move around and also to assemble. And so that was the name of the game, especially after the Cold War. And so I think that had a lot to do with the shift. Myanmar was one of the poorest countries in the world, so they needed to take advantage of the interest in its own country through its natural resources, which is why there was a rush for Myanmar as one of Asia's last frontier.
So then this roadmap, that has been moving in this direction and opening up gradually, then the question is now, why this coup now? What does the military benefit from this current action? Would they have squandered all that goodwill that has been building up? Elliot.
Yeah, so I think what Matinza, how she puts it, that, you know, on one hand, there's increased freedoms, but on the other hand, a sense that something isn't right only becomes really visible at a crisis moment like this. Because for so long, people who recognize, yes, there's increasing dislocation in the countrysides, people can't get jobs, or the NLD is leading and defending a genocide and consolidating power in an authoritarian manner, and the ethnic minorities remain unsatisfied, unintegrated, as Maitri said, but people would say, just wait. We need to give it a chance. It's a fragile democracy. Don't go out in the streets just yet. Don't undermine it. Well, now we have a reason for everyone to say together, we realize the 2008 Constitution is a sham and cannot lead this country forward. We realize this democracy, this transition, isn't leading us anywhere but to a dead end. So the irony here is that the military is actually maybe leading to an end to its own experiment, which it was benefiting a lot from.
Good point. Now let's talk about the challenges in the last 10 years of democracy in Myanmar, or we can call it a guided democracy or a hybrid system. Perhaps the top, I suppose, challenge was this uneasy truce on power sharing. Ed, could you comment on that challenge?
Putting the military alongside democracy is kind of untenable, because the military enshrined themselves in the constitution as a guarantor of democracy. Mm-hmm. Which gives them a veto power every time that they don't like what's happening in the country, they could come in, right? And whether democracy could survive under that condition when the military just jump in anytime they want, right? So they need a rethink about this model of disciplined multi-party democracy, because they felt alienated that there's discipline in the military, but the multi-party democracy that they were looking for probably is not working as they envisioned. And because Aung San Suu Kyi managed to outsmart the generals when the generals banned a president with foreign relatives, so she just created a new position. So they probably felt that the lady has outsmarted them. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is the time for them to tinker the constitution, think about the first past the post arrangement, maybe sideline the lady in future elections. Who knows? Mm-hmm.
With this coup, is this the end of democracy as we know it in Myanmar now, or just a setback? Or are we looking to a new form of government post-coup, and will the people accept it?
At this moment, I think this is still up in the air. I still think democracy seems to be the aspirational target for many different groups. I think the challenge, though, is not everyone shares the same sort of viewpoint of what that actually means. Mm-hmm. And so they have different visions of what democracy means, and they also have different methods of getting towards it. And there are different methods to get going towards it when you look at examples here in Asia, for instance. And so I think they have to find something that's going to be able, A, to find some sort of common ground and be able to be inclusive and to be able to represent the different worldviews and ideas that the many communities of the country have. And I don't think, frankly, it's necessarily going to focus, the solution is going to be in the political, to be honest. I think they need to focus on socioeconomic issues first, get that grounding. And everybody experiences poverty. Everyone understands the need for good hospitals, good COVID care, good education, these sorts of things. Maybe they need to take that step to find where the commonalities are. Because right now, it's clearly so divided. And I think, to answer your previous question, the biggest challenge to democracy is division, internal division. Mm-hmm. You have divisions within civilians, within parties, within the military, within ethnic groups. And I think finding that common ground is going to be, I think, the challenge for whoever's in charge of this country.
Okay. At this point, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take a look at international response. How have international leaders been responding to Myanmar's coup and now martial law? And will international reactions actually move the general to take a different direction? Stay tuned.
We will continue to discuss the situation with the relevant parties. Global society's any action must be aimed at strengthening the political and social stability of Myanmar. 有助于缅和平和解，避免激化矛盾，使局势进一步复杂化。
We believe we can work with the Congress on a package of sanctions to impose consequences in response to this coup. We will also be working with allies and partners around the world.
The UK Prime Minister has also condemned the coup and the unlawful imprisonment of civilians, including Aung San Suu Kyi.
Kita minta dua Menteri Luar Negeri untuk berbicara dengan Chair ASEAN guna menjajaki di...lakukannya pertemuan khusus Menteri Luar Negeri ASEAN mengenai perkembangan Myanmar.
Adalah dikhawatiri pergolakan politik di Myanmar boleh menjejaskan keamanan dan kestabilan di rantau ini.
Thanks for staying with Insight. We're at a special edition with a panel discussion.I'm trying to make sense of what's happening in Myanmar now and what does that mean for the future of democracy in the country. Now, a coup and now martial law, certainly it warrants an international response. But what form will it take? What options? And will it be effective? Let's start with the US. Now, this is President Joe Biden's probably first foreign policy challenge. Now, what has he said so far and what are the options available to the US? Elliot, want to kick it off?
Yeah, so I think that the U.S. really likes pretty legible narratives of good and evil where they get to be the cowboy to come in and save the day. And so the last couple of years with Aung San Suu Kyi defending genocide in front of the ICJ was very uncomfortable for the U.S. Their heroine had turned into a heel. But what this does is perhaps allows for a reset. It allows the military to retain the role of villain. It allows Aung San Suu Kyi to be the opposition figure who they will defend. And it allows a resignification of the earlier events. And what I mean by that, and you're seeing this already in groups of her supporters, saying, look, she never really wanted to defend the genocide. She just had to, because she was in a difficult position vis-a-vis the military. And so we need to let her off the hook. Now, I think as...outside analysts and historians, we need to, and others, we need to hold her to account for the choices that she made at the time. But I do suspect that we will see a rehabilitation of her image because it is expedient for foreign powers to do so.
Okay, Ed, what do you think? The U.S. options, are they limited?
Well, the U.S. does not have much leverage against Myanmar because to begin with, the generals are already under sanction. Mm-hmm.And they know that general sanctions would only hurt the population. U.S. investments are few. And if they push Myanmar too hard, Myanmar might just gravitate towards China. So they have to be careful about this. The good thing is that Kurt Campbell is the guy who negotiated with the generals in 2010. Mm-hmm. And he's also in charge. So he knows better than most anyone else. Mm-hmm.And he will play a different ball on this.
Okay. Thinza, what about yourself and people in Myanmar now? What are they expecting from the U.S.? What response do they hope to see?
We don't have big businesses here. We heavily rely on military businesses, military products. But now people realize they are enforcing military resources by consuming their products. Why not other different countries do sanction, a targeted sanction towards the military general, their businesses? So there are many different options. So I think the U.S. should take a lead on that role.
Okay. Now, speaking on taking a lead, now, Myanmar has another pillar, which is China, and that's the country's biggest trading partner. Maitri, may you comment on China's response so far? It's been very muted.You simply called it a cabinet reshuffle. What does that mean to you?
I think for the Chinese and their international role, they will play with whoever's in power, whether it's the generals or whether it's a civilian government. They have a long-term investment in the country, and they have shown over the years that they're entirely flexible. Mm-hmm. You know, but we also have to bear in mind that is also not just the Chinese investment, but...foreign investment in general tends to lubricate the differences that you have amongst the different stakeholders. Mm. You have some groups might be pro-China and investment, some might be pro-American and so forth, and money comes in different ways. And that also, again, intensifies those divisions, which I think are challenging the country right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Chinese are going to be there waiting and seeing. They can play the long game.
So with the polarization of, the two biggest influence in Myanmar politics, the U.S. and China then, are we going to see Myanmar shifting then into one orbit instead of the other? Previously, it was they were closer to then Clinton and Obama, and now are we going to see a move towards the other side?
Yeah, I think, first of all, Myanmar is geopolitically very important to China because there are two pipelines there, the gas, oil, and gas. And that's not a coincidence because the Chinese have thought that they would, in order to avoid the blockade in the Malacca Straits or South China Sea, they need Myanmar for the oil and gas as alternative route to China.
Yes.
Right? That's very important, plus the natural resources of China, plus the shipment, Europe and the Middle East. Myanmar is the place. Okay. So, yes, they would play the long game, whoever is in power, the military or the civilian government. And they don't want Myanmar to fall under the U.S. or Indian sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. They will keep Myanmar under the sphere of influence. So whoever sits in power will be Beijing will play with them.
Okay. Now, interesting. I mean, before the Tamador or the military armed forces in Myanmar pulled the coup or the martial law, clearly, I think they would have calculated that economic sanctions will be on the way. So it would have been in the calculations. Now, for them to pull it off then, have they then secured some other forms of economic assurances or political assurances that they could go forth with such a confidence? Maitri?
They probably have thought this through. The military doesn't take action very spontaneously. Mm-hmm. In the past 25, 30 years, we've seen this. They have other avenues, as we've seen. When the American sanctions and Western sanctions were put in place, they went to their Asian partners. Mm-hmm. And so I think they will go towards and rely on the fact that the U.S. is going to be focusing on domestic issues. Mm-hmm. They have huge COVID problems to deal with, not let alone working on their own divisions within the U.S. So I think they probably are banking on the fact that other partners will be available to them, other modes of money, the AIIB mm-hmm. might be an option rather mm-hmm. than the World Bank. So I think right now there's a different sort of set of financial options for them that were not there 25 years ago. So they may take advantage of these new developments that are happening in the Asia-Pacific region.
Finza, okay. How do you feel? Do you think the authorities or the powers that be in Myanmar can afford to ignore the Western sanctions?
They are trying to ignore the Western sanctions. This is the mindset of that military, not just right now, but a long time ago. They really hate the Western intervention. Even Aung San Suu Kyi, she was accused of, you know, marrying a foreigner and all these things. She was accused of many different things. Also, the nationality mindset. So they, as a military, they think manpower is the only power they can sustain themselves. But it's 21st century, it's 2021. Things have changed. We don't need that physical power. We need clear, soft power to eventually rule over, right? And this is what they are missing. And that's how now they are stepping up to show they are the boss. So I think they were trying to ignore the Western sanction and everything. They were largely relying on China and Russia, as we think.
Okay, I suppose, Elliot, maybe you can quickly wrap up this point for me then. Do you see a power shift, and which means the Myanmar military governments will be ignoring Western reactions?
Yeah, so I would start by saying that the West doesn't have a lot of leverage. I would agree with that. But what I would also add is that the military seems to be playing with fire here because they've multiplied the number of actors who are essentially in the game. And what I mean by that is that as they've essentially open up the economy, they've created vested interests who do not want to see these flows of capital and information and goods shut down. So in particular, these sometimes called crony companies who are in finance in particular and also in other construction and related sort of industries are not going to want to see this. So they are a group we might imagine is particularly upset. Then there are all the groups, the ethnic armed organizations, who also have their own vested interests, who see the end of the sort of peace process from this. You see a sort of, I could imagine that there is a sort of concern on the part of the military whether they can adequately pull this off. Mm-hmm. Now, they have been successful in the past, but what I think is interesting or a potential that comes from this moment is the is that people are going to say, why are we so poor and the military is so rich? Why are those sanctions from the West not going to be effective? Oh, it's because the military has these holding companies. Why do they have those holding companies? Why aren't they nationalized? Why isn't that going to the people? And those are the things I think that people like Matinza are putting on the table now that weren't on the table 2 weeks ago. Now, I don't want to be overly sanguine about this. Like, obviously, this is still a coup, which demonstrates the military is in power and is the one holding the cards. But things can change rather quickly, especially given the different forces that are mobilizing today.
All right, speaking of things changing rather quickly, eyes and expectations are now on another collective to exert pressure besides the US and China, and that would be ASEAN, the 10-nation group of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, of which Myanmar is a member state. Now, how can ASEAN affect the changes in Myanmar, and can Myanmar afford to alienate her closest neighbors? Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're watching a special edition of Insight, where we take a look at what's happening in Myanmar since the military coup on February 1st and now martial law, as well as to ask, is this an indefinite backslide to authoritarian rule in the country? Let's look at ASEAN, of which Myanmar is a member state and, of course, surrounded by her closest neighbours. Now, what can ASEAN do to change what's been happening in Myanmar, and will it be effective, Ed?
Well, this is an opportunity for ASEAN to assert itself as the solution to this internal regional problem.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I think ASEAN can also help Myanmar solve some of the developmental issues, fixing the voters list, acting as a guarantor and holding the general accountable for his promises, right? As a guarantor of credible commitment, because the general, they don't have any more trust outside. So maybe ASEAN could come in and say, look, we will help you on the roadmap back to democracy again, and we will put our name into it. It's like what happened with it during the roadmap 2003 democracy, what Kishore Mahbubani calls drip, drip, drip diplomacy, little by little. Don't rush it, but ASEAN will be there to move things along.
That's a great point, except that within ASEAN itself, the response to the coup has been rather divided and split. How is that going to affect progress of ASEAN, Maitri?
Well, ASEAN moves at its own pace, definitely, and it's not certainly a monolithic entity. It has different interests and different ways of seeing what's happening in Myanmar, and this is pretty much following the patterns of the past. People are of different minds when it comes to the Rohingya issue. People are of different minds when it came to Cyclone Nargis and so forth. But with Cyclone Nargis shows another example, as Ed was suggesting too, that they can step in and provide sort of a middle ground to facilitate the types of access that are needed. But this also goes, I think, with other partners too, who have invested a lot of time within Myanmar, the Japanese, the Koreans, Indians, and so forth. ASEAN has a vested interest in this, partly also because you have integration moving at different levels, both at the local level with ASEAN itself, but there's also the RCEP that was just signed recently. That's a massive investment by multiple countries. ASEAN cannot afford one of their neighbors to be holding things back. They need this integration. So I think they will try to play a quiet role, probably not something that's out in front-facing.
Let me quickly then draw to the Thailand's response to the Myanmar coup recently. Thai Prime Minister Prayut actually has called for ASEAN's collective stand on the coup, which is ironic since Prayut himself was the architect of the 2014 coup in Thailand. What exactly does he mean by ASEAN's collective stand on the coup? Is it to stand by the new military government or to jointly engage a different direction? Elliot.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one of the things that Matinza brings up is the sort of disjuncture between her experience with ASEAN people and her experience with ASEAN states. And so the sort of ASEAN that could usher Myanmar along as a sort of credible broker that Ed talked about in the 2000s may no longer really exist. It might have interests to have a stable partner, but it doesn't really have the democratic bona fides anymore. Whereas the her experience with the people demonstrate that there is some support. So I think we're at a place where we don't really know what Prime Minister Prayut's statement really means yet.
Ed, do you want to make a venture?
I'm just intrigued by that statement, Jen, because, you know, the military has intervened in Thai politics for so long a time, since 1932. Mm. And the Myanmar generals might be studying this model as well. It's possible to move from you know, your military suit to civilian government and still be a democracy and still attract investments. Mm-hmm. So there's a very powerful model for the Myanmar generals. Who knows, right?
Which is interesting because I think, like I said, we're talking about a split response, and that quite goes against the ASEAN Charter, which talks about the rule of law, which does not include coups, good governance, principles of democracy and constitutional governance. In fact, it was Indonesia who made a very particularly hard stand to stick to the ASEAN government. Is this coup a setback for ASEAN in general, Maitri?
It certainly is, if that is their objectives, is to get the type of democracy that is as envisioned by those who... countries who have actually reached a certain level of workable institutions and so forth. I think it is important that ASEAN plays a role to look at places like Indonesia that have gone through a lot of similar histories, and maybe to use ASEAN countries as their benchmark rather than other more mature democracies in Europe and North America, Australia, and so forth. Because your ASEAN neighbors also can also empathize with what you're going through. Most were colonized, both were also suffered through civilian and military tensions and multi-ethnic social situations with a lot of violence and civil war. So I think in that sense, looking towards your partners and looking for advice and using the type of common experiences that you have might be the way forward. Mm-hmm. Whether it's towards some shared sense of democracy, I really don't think so.
Thinza, I'm going to show this to you now. Now, the general has promised that there will be new elections, right? New elections after the one-year emergency rule. Now, what do you make of that promise? Do you believe in it? And what are you expecting?
Deja vu, right? So it sounds like a deja vu for all of us because they have made the same thing. They have made the same promise in 1990. So they coup because they want to coup. They will find all reasons, many reasons to coup, to justify the coup. Also, they will find different reasons to extend the coup. So that's what we think. So it's natural that we don't believe even... you know, everyone, even general citizens, you know, who have no knowledge about the politics, they wouldn't believe it. We are so tired of all these things, all these fake peace processes and fake democracy thing. Everything was so illusionary for us.
All right. Thank you for that. Lots of cynicism on the ground there, as we can see. One question I really like to ask as we draw to a close. Aung San Suu Kyi, now under a house arrest yet again, what can we make of her future? What will happen to her? What's next for her and the NLD? Elliot?
Yeah, so there's an old expression that if you fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And on one hand, Aung San Suu Kyi is very proud, and I think she believes she is the rightful ruler of the country, taking over the legacy of her father, and I think she wants to stand in front of it again. But on the other hand, it will be very difficult for her to trust to this set of institutions run essentially by the military, that this won't happen again and again. I also am skeptical that the military will allow her to take such an active role in politics.
Okay, Ed, very quickly, what do you think is going to happen to
Aung San Suu Kyi? Is 75, and the military knows that as well. Mm. And the general is 65. So they'll wait it out, and they'll probably try to ease out the lady, because the lady is the rallying symbol for the rest of the country. And the politics, the dynamics might change when the lady is out. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Maitri, very quickly.
I think her ideals will carry on. I think it will inspire, hopefully, a new generation of politicians and activists and so forth who want to take the country forward. But I think at the end of the day, the Myanmar folks have to decide it on their own. This is something they're going to have to clean up on their own. And I'm not sure that whether it's ASEAN or the West or China can help to really decide them on this. This is an internal matter. And I think hopefully you have more people who will be invested in that future. And maybe her legacy will be that she went up and did it, and maybe others will follow.
Thinza, very quickly, Aung San Suu Kyi, she's a hero in Myanmar. What do you think is going to happen to her next?
Even after she's been released, even after NLD get in power, nobody can assure that the coup will never happen again because of this framework, because the military used the constitution article to make this happen. So we are looking beyond this. We are, and also clearly Aung San Suu Kyi need to convince herself and her party members to make sure, you know, to go forward for an inclusive future, a better solution, sustainable solution.
One of the most powerful protest signs that we saw in the last couple of days is a big banner hanging over Leydan Junction that says there are no supreme saviors. And I think that's the thing that Myanmar people are struggling with right now. Their adulation for a leader who they do invest a lot in, but who has consolidated power, basically cheerleader for a genocide and not move things forward in very meaningful ways, and then the really powerful movements you're seeing on the street today. And it doesn't mean those tensions are going to resolve very easily, but I think that's one of the most important things that is coming out of this particular moment, is that at least they're starting to challenge those leaders.
Okay. So this, as this session draws to a close, I have one last question, and I'd like all of you to chime in a little bit. It's what I call my crystal ball question. Can Myanmar return to democracy after the situation this time? And if you could say one thing to the military leaders now, what would be your one piece of advice to them? Thinza, let's start with you.
I guess military wants democracy too, but in their own faction. Also, NLD wants democracy. That's their title. Also, people want democracy. That's our demand. We have kind of similar goal. So I think democracy is possible, but in a way that, you know, the military does not misuse the power they have, the resources they have. So clearly all about the mentality, all about the practice that they have. So we need to break that culture of coup. So that's the thing.
Elliot, can Myanmar return to democracy? What's one piece of advice you'd give?
I would say, rather than saying return to a flawed democracy, maybe this will be the chance to get to a better one. My advice for the military is to be satisfied with the long run of stealing the resources from Myanmar that they've enjoyed over the last 60 years and put their weapons away and go back to the barracks.
Ed.
Well, their model of democracy is disciplined, multi-party democracy. My advice is to be disciplined in not using force.
Thank you, Ed. And Maitri, last word for you. Well,
for half a century, the Myanmar has been trying to figure out what it is to be Myanmar. And so I think in terms of democracy, it may move a short few steps towards a version of democracy. It might work, it might not, but it's a journey. It's a step forward. I think the military needs to focus on their poverty, on the people, on the social economic foundations of the country, for anyone to actually even have the privilege of and luxury of thinking about ideology and political futures. They need to have homes and jobs and healthcare and so, those sorts of things. And that sort of, I think, binds us all, just beyond Myanmar. It's not just a Myanmar story. It's a story forever for the region and the world. So I think they should maybe take that in mind.
Thank you. And on that observation, that's all the time we have for this special discussion. Thank you for joining me. First, the shocking speed that the military coup happened on February 1st, how easily Aung San Suu Kyi's elected government was shut down. And now, martial law in major cities of Myanmar. Experts are unanimous in saying we don't have to wait long for martial law to take over completely. The coup has dealt a serious blow to the hard-won democratic reforms in Myanmar. It appears that the democracy experiment in the country has screeched to a complete stop. Shock, anger, and a deep sense of sadness and loss are driving hundreds of thousands to the streets. Is history set to repeat itself in Myanmar, where the military backslides into yesteryear's violent suppressions, as was in 1988 and 2007? An unstable Myanmar is bad news for everybody. But who will be able to effectively engage the army generals to change direction before the costs becomes too great?